of course, if you got people.
To say where we are. What we did last time is we ended with basically deciding that the period 56 to 59 seems to be a really
mm-hmm.
self, 52 to 56 seems
right.
to be a self-contained period. Then you start getting the physical changes
mm-hmm.
in the campus.
56 to, yeah.
And 56 to 57. Somewhere in there is when you attempted to create a de facto department by just
yeah.
taking over the offices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was still during Peterson's period.
Yes, I guess it would be.
I've been trying to look for
that's
something.
Where I'm, that's something I would really have to check, if it was still in Peterson's administration or if it came after McIntosh came.
Well, the department structure came after McIntosh.
Yeah, that's it. That's right.
But you're attempting
we're attempting,
to
I think
it could,
the department probably could have come, if it did come, it would have had to come very late then, probably to the end of 59.
Mm.
That I'd have to really
okay.
check.
And it felt, in going over the tape, what
yeah.
I felt was that what you did get during the period of begin in that period 56 to 59 with some sense of a little bit more faculty input.
Yeah, that's right. Toward the end of, what, 50?
57 to 80.
Yes, I think we were starting to get some there, yes. Mm-hmm.
And my sense was that we have a really good, from the last interview, really good sense of what all the implications of growth were in
okay.
student relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought what we could do is cover the 56 to 59
okay.
period in terms of all of the events surrounding
all right.
Peterson and the problems on the campus. Let me first ask, before we start with
uh-huh.
that, do you have a sense of other changes in that period relating to curriculum or the growth of the department or relationships with students as more of the buildings moved to the North Campus?
Well, let me just put it this way. Are we on tape now? Yes. Let me put it this way, Sherna, that I think much of our curriculum development will come a little bit later in the sense that we have tremendous growth in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
We will start specializing more particularly in the late 50s, even in this period, whereby, for example, I could introduce a course called Civil War and Reconstruction. Other members of the faculty could introduce specialized courses in the areas where they had intensive training. So from the point of view of my department, I think we see that kind of growth.
Mm-hmm.
But faculty in numbers will really be added in the 60s
mm-hmm.
rather than in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm. So most of the period 56 to 59, the focus really is on some of the developing internal strife.
I think so, plus the fact, and this I think would be of interest to all of us, in the sense that the department was a very cohesive group then. Someone said on the outside, if somebody started to attack, let's see, if you found another cause, you perhaps would be fractured as a department. But because you have found a common cause in fighting the administration, you have been unified. And I really believe that's true, because I think our department since has never had the unity which it had in the late 50s, small, I realize, but nevertheless, it was a unity whereby we met, we conferred, we were not fighting each other, we were fighting somebody from the outside. And in this case, it was definitely the administration. So if you look at campus government, now some departments on this campus wouldn't have had that same experience. They would have been split down the middle, as some indeed, to my knowledge, were.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of history, and I think probably it tells us something about the mentality of an historian who's concerned about, hopefully at least, justice and treatment, right treatment of people, human rights, that we saw historically what had happened when people didn't fight. Therefore, we felt it was necessary to fight. So I think what we did was to apply to a campus situation what we had seen happen in history.
Mm-hmm.
And not knowing all of us that much about what happened on other campuses, we nevertheless took the lessons of a greater situation, a society, or a group of people as they attempted to protect what they believed was right for them. And I think that's what happened here
mm-hmm.
on this campus, and especially in history. I believe that in history we had some of the most vocal people against the administration, except perhaps one person. But to mention those that were very vocal men like Dr. Howard Kimball, Dr. Richard Wilde, were the individuals that took this very seriously.
How about Nick Hardiman?
Nick Hardiman too, yes. Probably not as vocal in those days as he came to be later. Not that he wasn't, but he wasn't still as much a part of it. He came, I forget what year Nick Hardiman came, but nevertheless, when he did come, he eventually became a part of this. We said we had team spirit, and I think that's indeed what we did have. Hardiman came in 55, so you see that's just, well, he's getting in, but still not having tenure, and having to lie low, as it were. He wasn't as active a participant as the others.
So the most active in history, then, was yourself?
I was active, yes. Wilde was active. Kimball was active. You see, Wilde and Kimball both came in 1951, one of whom was not active in it, which probably somewhat negates what I said earlier about unity, Dr. Malam, who was later graduate dean and then for the last year before he retired, returned to our department to teach. He was quite pro-administration, and so he was not as active a part of it as the others. Don Peters was certainly very active. He came about the same time, I think, as Hardiman, roughly around that time.
Now, what seemed to be after the initial firing in 52?
Yeah.
Oh, I meant to ask you, in with those initial, I guess it wasn't considered filings, that's a non-retention.
Yes, right, dismissal.
What was the official reason given? Was the official reason questions about morality?
No. Let's remember that back at that time, before we really had established grievance procedures, an administrative officer could terminate the services of any faculty member without stating reason or cause. And therefore, they were simply told that you had a year-by-year contract, which is true, and we really never had contracts, simply letters saying you're reappointed for the ensuing academic year. So the only thing would be is that your services will terminate. This is a terminal appointment year for you, with no cause given. Now, where we came to believe what were causes is what we were able to surmise, not what we were told. Mm-hmm. And the administration never did reveal reasons for dismissal. The individuals that were being dismissed attempted to assess it to get answers and were never successful.
So you have that initial crisis, then you move on up to through to 56,
yes.
The growing campus.
I think we need to say in those years after the initial crisis that Roy Simpson, who was the superintendent of public education for the state of California and under whose jurisdiction the state colleges were, did establish an investigation, and with the investigation found out that there were a number of irregularities in the administration of this campus, and to our knowledge spanked Peterson's hands, as it were, because Peterson had to yield on a number of things, including the establishment of a faculty council. And again, Howard Kimball can give you the dates. He has all the records on the early organization of the faculty council, and he could give you the exact dates. I don't recall whether it came, 53, 54, if it was 55, 56, because I just don't have documents for that period. But Howard Kimball could give that to you. But there were attempts to have more committee structures, not that we were that effective, but at least we were going through the motions of committee action, and I think Peterson came to see that this was not something that one could continue to control that easily, and especially with growth. All right, I believe in the period from 56 to 58, we're up to 59, we continue basically to have the same problems, and that is the problem that I think has plagued this campus throughout its history. And that is the understanding of what is the role of the faculty in the government of the institution of higher learning. I think faculty have basically, as I look at it historically, have been very jealous of their role. They believe that they are legislators, that they do not have certain functions which may be defined by state law or education codes, but in areas relating to curriculum, in areas relating to assessment of faculty performance, and the ability to then make recommendations to the proper administrative officers. They should have a role. They likewise should have a meaningful role when it comes to students, the admission of students. Perhaps even if there are priorities on admissions, the faculty should have some say-so. And I think some of our faculty, though many of us had not had that kind of experience widely in other institutions, there were enough in our faculty who had been at other schools of higher learning, and likewise who had done enough reading on academic government, who believed very, very strongly in this concept that we were not employees. We were professional people. And the only difference between us and the administration was in definition of function or role. But the administration was no better educated than we, you know, this type of thing. So we held PhDs, they held PhDs. And that also the belief that probably not every faculty member, in the terms of the Jacksonian Democrat, could nevertheless be an administrator. But the idea that within every faculty member there might be at least the possibility of a potential for being an administrator. So therefore, what makes an administrator different from a faculty member? And the concern that when people did become faculty or become administrators, they might forget the role that they once had as a faculty member and the frustration that might ensue from the kinds of things, petty things, that one would have to deal with. Now, in the period between 56 and 59, again, it is faculty dismissals that tend to be the problem. I think the big case, and I can't remember whether it was 57 or 58, is what we call the Frank Black Clyde Martin case. The one individual, Clyde Martin, is dead. Frank Black still lives, I believe, in the area and would be an individual, no doubt, to contact on this, because this becomes probably the most crucial thing, the Black Martin case. It's almost as if we're citing a Supreme Court decision, it seems. But
let me ask, between the initial firings in 52 and the Black and Martin case, there were no other incidents like that?
I think there were dismissals, but nothing in the sense of people really being that concerned. Plus the fact that you were starting now to bring people in again, looking at their rate of growth, they were being considered for tenure appointments, and if when the tenure appointments came along, and especially if they weren't granted. Now, if they were not granted and it was known that the faculty member was ineffective and not performing the job that he or she should be doing, you wouldn't see this. But it was when faculty tended to believe and had to be shown otherwise that a faculty member was not being effective or wasn't effective in his job or her job, that the faculty came to the support of another faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
The feeling was that the campus continued to be politically divided. By that we refer to campus politics, and that if a person was known to be a supporter of the administration, that person's chances of being retained, being promoted, were very good. But if you're one who ever spoke out against policy, it may not be personal, but it might have been against policy, you were looked upon as being perhaps an individual that was a recalcitrant gadfly, you know, that was causing a lot of trouble, and the inability to keep your nose clean.
Mm-hmm. Another question. Were there faculty during this period, say up to 56, who had begun to move on the campus itself, who had begun to move into administration and being incorporated into the administration?
Yes. I can't say with certainty who might have moved into that, because as I recall, our administrative personnel continued to be pretty much the same. The only one I can think of was a fellow named Bob Rhodes, who was in science and who moved up into administration in a dean's capacity, and again, who had been a very close friend of Peterson's at San Jose State College. And not highly, Bob is dead, so you can't interview him, but nevertheless, Bob was a man who talked down to the faculty.
Mm.
And the feeling was that he addressed us in a rather elementary fashion. And you felt almost insulted at times that he talked to you as if you were elementary school children. And that became a little bit of a problem, too. So we saw, you see, among other things, the feeling that science is commencing to dominate.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Peterson, a chemist. Here's Rhodes, a biologist. Ken Johnson was brought in from San Jose State as well to chair the natural sciences, when there were other faculty who had been here, such as Ross Hardy, who perhaps would have been a logical person to head up the natural sciences as we went into the divisional structure, but yet was not given that opportunity. I think that kind of hostility, that kind of a feeling, was felt and exercised and demonstrated by a number of faculty. That is, there was no opportunity if there was an opening to apply for it. No such thing as we're aware of today. Here's an employment opportunity. Here's an opening. The closing date is such and such. No such thing was done. Suddenly you knew that somebody was appointed to another position. And you looked at people in the administration with the fact that what have they done to please the president? Mm-hmm. That's the way it was seen. Mm-hmm. And I do believe, you know, for all fairness, that these individuals need to be interviewed, like Carl Russell, for example, who is still on campus but in counseling, and who was dean of students, would certainly see things in a light quite different from what many of us would have seen. And his perspective, you know, can be very valid because, or can be valid in the sense that he was closer to things than some of us who were teaching, and he may therefore have, you know, adequate and meaningful interpretations. Lois Swanson certainly should be interviewed in this area as well. And I think we've spoken of others that should be.
I asked mainly because I wondered if it was something that almost exacerbated some of these feelings, was that there were some people being selected from the faculty who were brought into the administration. I thought that might possibly contribute.
I don't think we have too much of that because there wasn't the growth in administrative positions at that time. And what positions were filled as divisions were organized, the president made all the decisions. There was no faculty committee that ever entered into a decision-making situation where an administrative officer was to be appointed.
I didn't mean to divert you about this. I just wanted to make sure that why it was that the Black case ended up being one of the first ones.
All right. I think the Black Martin case is interesting in the sense that for the first time, the School of Education was touched. It was not called then the School of Education. I'm using present-day terminology. But the Department of Education, or Division of Education, I guess is correct. When both Martin and Black, who were faculty members there, were being denied, and I forget whether it's reappointment or tenure, but it becomes the famous, or perhaps infamous, depending upon whose point of view, the Black Martin case. And it related to, I know, non-reappointment, with no real answers given, which led a number of the faculty to believe that we're going back again, we're regressing, we're going back to what had happened, even new faculty members who had been told, and I might say incidentally that though I did not play this role purposely, though I was asked questions, when new faculty came, many of them were sort of given a little exercise in history. Let me tell you what's happened on this campus, that type of thing. And I think some of our faculty purposely wanted to win people to their side. It was almost as if we were continually engaging in the political contest, and you're trying to get registered voters. So you start to get this type of thing. And out of it, this Black Martin situation, as I say, many individuals in education became extremely excited and disturbed, plus people outside. And we had the establishment, and I just had to write this down. It was called the FARC group, which is Faculty Administrative Relations Committee, which was an ad hoc committee. It was never, to my knowledge, given the blessing of the administration. But it was a committee that felt that something had to be done to try to carry on communications with the administration as to what was happening on campus and why there was no input from faculty when it came to firing your own colleagues. And I think we need to recognize that a faculty unity was building up in these years, that you almost felt defensive, that the faculty, in order to survive, had to either organize or have something that would be a mouthpiece for them. This committee...
Was there an attempt to reinstate Black and Martin?
There was a desire, yes. And there again, there are people like let me give you some names that I think could fill in some of this information. I think George Appleton in physics, Dick Wilde, who was, you know, in an interim appointment as academic administrative assistant to associate vice president or assistant vice president in charge of academic affairs, Bill Fogg in education, psychology, Kramer Schultz in physics, both Appleton and Schultz in physics, to my knowledge, were very, very much involved in this. Erich Mathsin in philosophy, Bert Conroy in geology, Herb Winter in French. I think these were, and probably the latter three, Massey, Winter, and Conroy, might have been more involved in the Black Martin case than others. Henry Seaman, S-E-H-M-E-N, who's retired professor emeritus, lives here in Park Estates, I think could give you an awful lot about the Black Martin case. And a man with a, I think probably who has kept a lot of documents and who would love to be interviewed, I'm sure. Just by way of a footnote, he lost his wife last fall. And, you know, whether he leaves the area, I don't know, because his relatives and family are back in Illinois. But he'd be a good man to interview because he also was, and I forget the years of his tenure, he was also chairman of the Division of Education. He knows an awful lot on both sides and would know the Black Martin case, I think, very, very well, because he came here very early in the history of the institution. We also find at this time that a group of these individuals, the Faculty Association, the Faculty Administrative Relations Committee, to my knowledge, and there you'd have to find out from some of these other people, even went to Sacramento. A group on their own went to Sacramento to discuss the issues of the case with Simpson.
What was the structure? How was that committee structured?
I just don't really remember, Sherna, just how it got organized. I know that there were, to begin with, and there again, I may be wrong, but others with documents could tell you. We did have a group of individuals who organized as 15 full professors, who felt they had tenure, they couldn't have their promotions taken away from them. So that would be 1958-59, right around in there, because I was promoted to a full professor effective, I think, the fall of 58. A number of the others had been full professors for a number of years. Some had come as full professors because of their age, their experience, and all the rest. But 15 full professors literally put their heads on the in the guillotine, not realistically, I guess, but to a degree, by saying, we are out to see that, you know, proper justice is given to faculty on this campus, and that there are reasons given to faculty if they're going to be dismissed, because how can you improve yourself if you're not told? And the feeling was that dismissals were that the people who were being discharged or whose appointments were being terminated had not acted in the proper political fashion. Now, a lot of that detail I'm not fully acquainted with. I did not get as involved in the Black Martin case as other people whom I'd mentioned. I think they got very involved. I think a man that could probably give you a great deal about the Black Martin case also is Bill Fogg in educational psychology. He knows probably the details as well as anybody and also has a tremendous gift for expressing himself in on tape. I think it could go for hours, just what he'd tell you. But those are some of the individuals that I know were involved. These are the years also that are very critical for Ross Hardy in zoology, the biological sciences, where moral charges were pressed against him. And his attorney, and this is where a number of us got really upset, and I was among them as well, contacted Walter Desmond, an attorney here in Long Beach, who incidentally probably would be one that you'd like to contact sometime. Walter Desmond, an attorney in Long Beach, still practicing, who took on Ross Hardy's case. And of course, in time, Ross Hardy won. The charges brought against him were unbelievable. Students were used and even given certain promises that if they would And this is the way I understand it. You know, this again, as I say, where I know what an historian is up against in using evidence. And so I also, you know, at this moment, guard myself by saying what I understood was that some of these students, in some cases graduate students, were given certain promises of either jobs on campus or other things that were enticements that could be used to draw them in if they would testify against Dr. Hardy. Again, what's interesting, the charges as they were, as we understood them, though not officially stated, at least in the case of those original firings in 52, it seemed once again to be in the area of morality. And in this case, it was, of course, a charge of homosexuality. And charges brought by students about happened on camping trips. They had to go on trips to get specimens and so forth. Ross Hardy came out, I think, basically with a clean bill of health. The administration had to withdraw its charges. But I do believe that part of it is that Ross Hardy had spoken out on many, many issues which aggravated the administration.
What were the issues?
All right. Ross Hardy first has to be understood and one who must be interviewed. Ross Hardy has a memory of these events because he was such a significant participant that will be unbelievable, plus the fact that he does have an excellent memory for detail and was one of the original faculty members. But Ross Hardy had spoken out on a number of things, as I remember, such things as, because he bought a lot in Park Estates and paid a regular price, that there were members of the administration who had been given either lots at a very small price, or if it wasn't given lots at a small price, at least they were given great deductions. He also spoke of the fact that the president probably was getting things from the campus, such as wood, supplies for putting in a sprinkling system. All these things, Ross, and again, I recognize, I don't think always use good judgment, but these were things he was talking about, that here are things that are basically unethical, that are going on. And of course, you must remember that the feeling against Peterson had not subsided. The feeling that, quote, among many, though I don't feel I felt that much by 58, 59, that I had felt earlier, but I still felt that there was justice that had to come forth and reign. But there were many who said, Peterson's got to go, and how do we do it? I think Ross Hardy would be one of those by saying, here is a man that's done these things, and in occupying this kind of a position, are you supposed to be taking equipment or tools or whatever? Also, was he working closely with Bill Grant, who had sponsored the legislation?